This is a Power 98.7 podcast. Now we're talking. Subscribe to Power 98.7 podcasts in iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. There's more on power987.co.za.
I'm joined by Dr. Craig Moffat, who is currently in Norway. He is the head of program, governance delivery and impact for Good Governance Africa, an NGO headquartered here in Johannesburg. Dr. Craig Moffat, good evening and welcome to Power Perspective.
Good evening, sir. How are you?
I'm very well. And how are you doing?
All right, thank you.
You must be freezing, though, in Norway at this time of the year.
Yes, it is. Yes, we had a bit of a storm early on, so the line's a bit bad. So if it acts up, I apologize. But then again, you already, you know, gave me a platform to use English bundles. I'll use that platform.
Well, absolutely. I hope you are loaded up on your bundles. I don't want them to deplete before we finish this conversation. You've written a piece for Good Governance Africa with Monique Bennett, which is Uganda Elections Tracker 2021. What are some of the key highlights that you can give us about where Uganda is at the moment, 2 days before the polls?
Okay, before I start, let me just congratulate you on your new show, and I wish you all the best going forward. And good evening to everyone in South Africa and across the world, whoever's listening. Just some quick facts about Uganda, just so that we can understand where we're at. I think you asked very pertinent questions earlier in your introduction, when you were saying, are elections free, fair, and credible? Unfortunately, there isn't a yes and a no box. You know, it's all degrees. You know, sometimes it's gray, sometimes it's light gray. You know, so that's the unfortunate thing about election observation. The numbers may be more precise, but the process may be a bit, you know, skewed or, you know, so, yeah, it's not an easy thing to assess always. But just some quick facts about the elections, I mean, so far, is that Uganda, one of the biggest points that the president and the leading opposition leader is pressing for is this youth vote. As you mentioned, I mean, Uganda at the moment has some say 75% of the population is under the age of 30 years old. So it's a very young population. Both of the candidates are going for that vote because a lot of the voters are first time voters also. So that is where they are. And as you rightly said, the push-ups that he's been doing, he calls them his grandchildren, and he has quite a following of people that are following him, watching him do the push-ups. Also, it seems that there are many that actually appreciate him calling them grandchildren. You know, so there's that side. Then there's the opposition side, which obviously is calling for change, is calling for new ways, is calling for, you know, just a new political direction. You know, so you have those two competing against each other. So far, there are 11 contenders. We have 10 men and one female presidential candidate. Museveni, as you rightly said, he's already served 5 terms, and so he wants a mandate for his sixth term. We've seen the month of November saw vast clashes between the security apparatus and the supporters of the opposition. I mean, we had on between 2 days, you had, I mean, 49 people killed between November 18th and November 19th. There was 49 people killed, 100 wounded of opposition supporters. Then you've seen, I mean, at a daily rate in November, you had attacks on across the opposition landscape. So it's not just Bobby Wine's party, it's across them. They've all been impacted in some way, which led to them in December to suspend their campaigns. While it may be seen as a justified stance to postpone their campaigns, it obviously gives the incumbent more power because it allowed the incumbent at that point to be able to strengthen his hand. You know, so while they can be admired for showing a unified stance, I'm not sure if it in the end will help them, just due to the fact that currently the Electoral Commission has banned any public events. So they have to do it online. So if you don't have a presence, especially with the youth, you are left behind. So they're playing a catch-up game, it seems like. Whereas at the same time, while there's been this ban in this ban on public gatherings, you have the incumbent that's held rallies, and these rallies have gone off with success. So it's a bit of a, you know, it's a bit of a he wins just by being the incumbent. And as you rightly know, is that, I mean, for incumbent to be removed from power, it needs a lot. If you look at the Malawi instance, for instance, they realized that they had to form an alliance. But it's no good just forming an alliance. I think in the Malawi example, where the opposition in Tanzania was supposed to learn, and they did learn, but it was a bit late, is that in Uganda, is that you have to have one head, and then the other parties must be act as a supporting cast. If they don't support him, then it doesn't help, because then you have too many bulls in a crowd for a, you know, lack of a
now Dr. Moffat, I want to come in there. You are talking about, you know, coalitions in other countries that have actually, you know, yielded fruits in terms of unseating incumbents or bringing about change to make shifts in the electorate. Are we seeing any pre-election coalitions emerging out of Uganda, or are the opposition parties still going it alone, even though they appear to act at times, whether in solidarity or because of the brutality of the system that they confront, insofar as suspending their campaigns, which happened in December? It was not only Bobi Wine's political party that, you know, suspended its campaign. There were other two opposition presidential candidates that actually suspended their campaigns. Are we seeing any forms of coalitions emerging in Uganda?
Okay, there's two interesting formations of, is that the last leader of the Dr. Keza, who has run against Museveni, I think four times, has put his support behind Wine now.
Yes.
So that's the one change. However, there hasn't been like a pact of opposition formed yet. However, what they have done, which is an interesting development in Uganda, is that they've formed a pact to help with the counting of the ballots after elections. But obviously, they feel that they're not safe, so they haven't announced where they're going to do it, but they want to then count themselves also. So this is a new, I haven't seen this formation yet, where
yes.
they have this sense of we need to count it so we can see, you know. I guess it's another layer of transparency, you know. So that's been interesting from this election.
And talking about transparency, are we seeing a lot of interest in terms of deploying election observers from the continent and internationally?
From the continent, the EAC indicated that they will deploy. So, but trying to find information is really hard. If you go to their website, it's really hard. But they were supposed to have two deployments, one longer term deployment from December, and obviously a shorter term from January. So as I speak, I can't confirm if they're on the ground, but I would assume that they are on the ground already. From the EU side, they've said no. They're not going in. They first used, obviously, the pandemic as an excuse, but it came to light that they are a bit aggrieved by the fact that every time they write an election report, it's not heeded. So it's seems a bit like sour grapes, which, you know.
And who are they blaming for this in terms of their reports not being heeded, or some of their recommendations not being taken and actually implemented? Are they placing blame on the Ugandan government, or are they placing blame even maybe on the AU as a body?
No, the blame in this is on the Ugandan government only, because the AU isn't, I mean, they're not running the election. They are observers also. But in this election, again, finding whether the AU has deployed, it's proved a little difficult, you know. So that's the interesting part. the UK, since they're no longer part of the EU, they are deploying as well. So they've asked for just under 50 accredited representatives for this election. So whether that is a sign against the EU, I don't know. But so they will be deploying. So what the EU has asked for is for diplomatic representation on the day. So their embassies will then just track what happens in that day. But as you know, with elections, obviously a proper election observation team deployment works better because it looks at the whole process. Whereas if you deploy on the day only, you're only looking at the day. So the day may be free and fair, but leading up to the day after November, after December, it wasn't free and fair.
And I think you are raising something important in terms of how do we determine a free, fair, and credible election, because there tends to be a lot of focus on events of the day. How did the voting go on? Why is it that it seems as if the build-up, I mean, I remember reading back then, I mean, the Kapembe report on Zimbabwe's elections back then. I mean, President Thabo Mbeki had commissioned that report at the time, and there was a lot of emphasis in that report that even the legal framework that governs elections is important to interrogate to determine whether elections will be free, fair, and credible.
I think the short answer, because there's a very long answer, obviously,
yes.
the theoretical answer, I think the short answer is just that it's a sovereignty issue. Is that, for instance, if you do find that there were abuses, what can you really do? You know, so then they hide behind the sovereignty. They look at the day and say, no, on this day, the polling stations opened on time. There were observers allowed to be there. There was enough ink. There was enough ballot forms. There was order. There was no intimidation. Then that comes across as free and fair. Do you see? So I think the whole process, it's a bit difficult to point a finger when you know that you do the same thing. You know, I mean, if you look at the region in East Africa, the only country recently that's had a change of president was Burundi, but that's because the president, you know, he died
just on the eve.
You know, exactly. So if you look at Rwanda, you look at Tanzania, you look at Kenya, you look at, it's either the same ruling parties or it's the same leaders. You know, so how do you say you are wrong, but you do the same thing?
Now, Dr. Moffat, just quickly, there's something quite curious about Museveni, 35 years almost in power. He's not the most democratic leader. He has cracked down on opposition leaders, but he has also targeted certain groups. I mean, he runs quite a highly homophobic government that creates laws and rules that are very quite bizarre by any measure and standard. What is it that has sustained him to appear as though he's democratic, or what is in it for other countries to sustain this image of a democratic leader when it comes to Museveni?
I think like all leaders that are revolutionaries, for lack of a better word at the moment, is that he has done good for Uganda in those years. Not all the time, but I mean, if you look at Amazon in Somalia, he was the first to send troops.
Yes.
So that you get, you know, political credit and mileage for that. So in the AU, he has a voice because currently, if I'm not mistaken, they still have the most troops, even though there are talks of withdrawals now. But so he has that power. In South Sudan, I mean, Uganda is a conduit of food and transport and logistics into South Sudan, right? So he has done that with the Americans, the Lord Resistance Army. I mean, Bill Clinton at one point, I think it was in 98, said that of Museveni, he is the new generation of African leaders to take Africa further. You know, so it isn't as if he started bad.
Absolutely,
you know,
not.
So in Uganda, I mean, at the same time, is that I think the youth that will vote for him they do it because they want to maintain the peace that is in Uganda at the moment. Because you have Somalia on the one side, you've got South Sudan on the other side, you have DRC on the eastern part of DRC, is that he's been able to keep it relatively peaceful. And I think that has allowed some of his indiscretions, and not downplaying what he's done that's been wrong, but some of those indiscretions, people overlook it. Because they say, if you look at the bigger picture, it's better to have him than have someone else, which is not right. But,
yeah.
You know, this game of politics, that's how they play it.
Yeah. Just before I ask you the next question that I have for you, I just want to invite our listener to dial in if they want to pose a comment, a question, or share a thought or comment, or what they think about the upcoming elections in Uganda, the presidency of President Museveni and his legacy in office. Why should we care about elections in Uganda? Our lines are open at 0861-987-000, 0861-987-000. And you can, of course, tweet me at Lukona Mguni. You are still listening to Power Perspective, and I'm in conversation with Dr. Craig Moffat, zooming into the upcoming elections in Uganda on the 14th of January, which is this Thursday of this week. Now, Craig, I want to ask you a question. Could it be that partly what sustains Museveni in power is in actual fact the weakness of the opposition in Uganda? When you look, for example, at Bobi Wine, who is probably one of the most prominent opposition politicians in the country, how strong are his politics? How strong is his messaging in terms of reaching the electorate?
I think you've hit the nail on the head. I think that his political acumen is questioned by some. Yes, I know that he came from being a reggae singer, and reggae singers can become politicians. But I think that he may lack in political acumen, so that may also turn people off. And like I said, Uganda finds itself in a situation where it can have neighboring influences affect it. And Museveni, for the moment, stops that from happening. Whereas with Bobi Wine, well, we're not sure if that can happen, because if he's able to command the respect at the AU, if he's able to command the respect of the other leaders in the region, if he's able to get Uganda behind him, you know. So I hate to say it is age, because I mean we've seen on the continent we have a DJ that became a president, and he was elected twice. Well, he was overthrew and then he was elected.
Yes.
You know, in Madagascar. So I mean, we have George Weah, who was a soccer player. So those coming with fame can do the job if they have to. So I think with him is that, I mean, here in South Africa, we have obviously our the opposition parties. We have the EFF. We have the former DA leader. They both have political clout with them, so people follow them. With Bobi Wine, it may just be his fame that's pulling the youth with him. I can't give a definitive answer of whether he is strong enough himself to actually lead the country if he does win the election, which is wrong, because we always say Africa has aging leaders and we need youth. But I don't know. I'm not saying that he can't do it, but I don't think that he has the political maturity at this moment to lead yet.
Now, there's something that you allude to, which is also very important. So if it's not the crackdown on opposition politicians, it is the crackdown on media. You write in your piece that in December 2020, the government actually revoked media accreditation for all foreign journalists, including those already registered to cover the election. Can you just talk us through this, and what is the possible impact on the credibility of these elections?
Well, I mean, the thing is, remember, for the elections to be valid, because if you look at if you if the you the Minister of Information, he recently said that we don't need foreign press to tell us that we're doing the right job, right? So obviously, if you are a follower, you will say yes, we don't need foreign media, right? But if you want to be objective, you do need the foreign media to be able to balance what comes out, because obviously, if with this a crackdown on foreign press, but also press that have been, you know, more or seen as sympathetic to the opposition. So we've seen that play out also. So the Museveni uses his incumbency to use state media to push his agenda, which obviously he abuses it because of this. Even if you look at the pandemic, he's been able to show that he has done well in the pandemic, which he has number-wise. You know, he's been able to curb it the same way as he was the same president that was there when the AIDS epidemic started. He was able to get his health system in order. So people know this about him. So the foreign press may come and show and highlight that there were gross violations, but the ones that follow him are mostly in the rural areas, so they may not listen to foreign press. So there is no space not to have foreign press or independent press. You know, so
yes.
What he's doing there is an abuse, and I would like to see if the EAC writes their report, if that will be noted, because it does impact the election.
Now, an organization like yours, Good Governance Africa, besides just writing some of these things, you want to make sure that they catch the attention of policymakers and so on. Which body in the continent should actually be ensuring, enforceability of certain things that we take as universal accompaniments of democracy, free press, political tolerance, free campaigning without intimidation, fear, and all of that?
But that's why we need long-term election observers, is so that process can be followed and tracked. You see, but as you know, on the African continent, the idea of subsidiarity is very strong. So the AU looks to the EAC first,
yes.
And the EAC will have to do it first, and then report to AU if they need help from the AU. But the AU won't overstep. You see, so again, it's that each rec, the sovereignty of each state in each rec it's very serious. So I don't know if there's one body that can do it. However, in an election period, maybe it's best then once the recs, when they deploy, they look at all these issues systematically and not just brush over it, you know, and say and call it out that there were media abuses, there were these abuses, there were these atrocities, and that forms part of the end report. And I think it's the recs that need to be called to order so that they can do their work as the regional body that's supposed to oversee these things. You see, but obviously in each country there are institutions that are also supposed to do these things. But obviously if the head of state is in charge and that doesn't allow those institutions the freedom and the space to work, you have to look at the recs.
Now, Craig, I mean, Donald says to me, for as long as we have leaders who can manipulate election systems in Africa, then let's forget about democracy. Now, this issue keeps coming up, you know, democracy. Do we need some type of democracy in the continent that is not necessarily borrowed from, you know, from liberal democracy that we see in most Western countries? What do you say about this? Should we remain hopeful about democracy? Because it is almost as if, you know, incumbents tend to abuse their incumbency to sustain their power, shut out opposition, even shut out the voice of the people. Because when they shut out opposition, they make it impossible for citizens to actually have a genuine choice and be able to express themselves. So what is the hope? I mean, we saw a lot of the democracy wave, particularly in the 90s in the continent, a number of elections. But over time, we have been seeing some form of, you know, manipulation of constitutions, people extending their terms in office. We saw it in Rwanda with Kagame. We saw it in Senegal with Wade, but it didn't work. didn't work out so well
in Uganda itself, in Senegal.
We've seen it in Uganda. So what is the hope for democracy in the continent as you see it?
Let me tell you a quick story. When I was at university, I worked for the BBC, on my off time. And one of the producers told me a story about Museveni. She interviewed him once, and he said something to her. He said that democracy is like water. You know, it takes on many different shapes and forms, but you can't expect me to bathe in ice.
Yes.
And that's always stuck with me. And I think that each leader takes a form of democracy that pleases them. And I think that a universal democracy sometimes is hard to prove. America has shown us that now. You know, so I think democracy as a concept itself, I think everybody takes what they want from democracy and say, I am democratic because I do this. However, on this side, I may not do this, but I do enough of that. So it's sufficient. Do you see? And I think when Museveni said, you know, that you can't bathe in ice, it still is a form of water.
Now, it is quite clear that you are saying it's the leaders who define and not necessarily the citizens that must or who define, because citizens ought to define who governs how they are governed, and they be given that opportunity to actually, you know, express their will, because we say that, you know, democracy is government of the people, by the people, with the people. Would you say that with all what you have said about Museveni, as we probably try bring this conversation to a close, as we head to the elections on Thursday, can we expect an upset, or this election is going to be a walk in the park for him, if we can call it an election?
I mean, they say never, but I think that Museveni will probably take this election. Whether it'll be, he'll take it in a free and credible way, probably not. But will he be called to order from the EAC or from his regional neighbors or from the AU? That's the million-dollar question. And if he is called to order, do they have the means to remove him?
I think,
you know, I mean,
that is a big talking point, because it's always a question of what happens. Say an observer mission says we don't deem these elections to be free, fair, and credible, but the election body in the country actually says no, they were free, fair, and credible elections.
Exactly. So then you go to the courts. Malawi showed us that the courts did overturn it. So it can be done if your judiciary is independent. You know, so I think the Malawi example showed us that, and the Kenyan example as well, it can be done. And the Malawi example led to a change of the incumbent, which is almost unheard of on the continent.
Yes. And what had happened by chance there, though, was a change first and foremost of the head of the electoral commission.
Exactly.
In the country.
Yes. The justice was changed. Exactly. But in Uganda now, if you want to use that argument, the new justice, I mean, the previous chairperson, he, in the last elections, I mean, there were many instances where they showed that he was wrong, but he was kept, the last election was his third election, and he was removed now. And this new one, the new justice, he seems to be, you know, let's give him the benefit of the doubt, and let's see if he will do the right thing, if there's a need to do the right thing.
Absolutely. Dr. Craig Moffat, I think that is a good place for us to leave this conversation all the way from Norway. Please keep warm and return to the country warm and safe. That is the head of program, governance, delivery and impact for Good Governance Africa, Dr. Craig Moffat, helping us unpack what is happening in Uganda, particularly in the lead up to these elections that we have in our agenda coming up on Thursday, the 14th of January, as Uganda goes to the polls and decides. You are still listening to Power Perspective with me, Lukona Mnguni. The clock is just 21 minutes before 11. We have reached that final 30 minutes of the show. I do invite you to an open line to reflect on that conversation with Dr. Craig Moffat, or something that we have spoken about, or a view that you wanted to express when we had our open line and you were unable to, or there is a conversation we were having in the initial open line and you felt that perhaps we cut it short. So let's keep that open line. You are still listening to Power Perspective.
You've been listening to a Power 98.7 podcast. For more podcasts, visit power987.co.za or subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.